I'd like to welcome everybody that's here. Today is our public hearing. It's the public's chance to question, comment, suggest, participate, and hopefully continue to stay involved. Our entire board is here. Looks like we've got a couple members of the public. By way of introduction, let's just go around the horn. Everybody introduce themselves. This is not, we're neighbors, and it should be pretty easy to. Rob?
Yes, Rob Cabot.
Okay.
Bob Bingham.
Jim Harvey.
Ron Wilson. I live over in Snowflake, if you're familiar with the area.
Carrie Zanger, District Clerk.
Roy Walker, Manager.
We've got a couple people still trying to connect. Good evening, sir. John Plunkett. I can read your name.
Hi there.
And there's a Nikki DeForge who.
Yes, I'm an attorney. I'm representing Mr. Plunkett and some other neighbors who own lots up in the area.
Good. Good. Well, let's go ahead and get started. We've got an agenda. We've got several business items that we welcome public comment, questions, and open discussions. So let's just go ahead and get started. Item number one is the 2023 tentative budget. We've been working on a tentative budget for several months now. The tentative budget is actually on our web page for those interested in it. But in terms of just providing a broad overview, I'd like to ask Roy Watts, our district manager, to provide some discussion in terms of our budgeting process and what we look to do and how we hope to meet your needs by maintaining a balanced budget.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. So each year, of course, with most public entities, we look back to see how we did in our previous years and look at least 3 years and consecutive years, and then tracking expenses and things are changing. Then we develop, of course, a budget off of that with income and expenses and capital expenses. And over the last 3 years, our costs have gone up slightly, and so has the income. Some of it is planned for capital needs and payment of bonds and other things. And of course, some of it is just the fact that as we take over infrastructure and start to take care of the maintenance of things that are turned over to us, there are costs that go along with, like water rights and paying for those water rights and management of the sewer stations and electricity and staffing and everything else, and that drives the budgets. And so with that, of course, is the 2023 budget. Got $1,489,438 that we're proposing as a budget, and the same thing with the expenses. The biggest change is probably that we've seen in the budgets is has been the cost of the transfer of the infrastructure and taking on costs of water rights and newer infrastructures coming, which would be pump stations and lift station maintenance and those kind of things. Lift stations can be as much as $100,000 a year to take care of, and so we're starting to see some of that now become part of the more of the everyday life of the district. And as you acquire and maintain the infrastructure, of course, maintenance costs, equipment go up, as well as the cost of buying parts and staffing and take care of it and their certifications and other things. So that's what's mostly driving the budget where it's at. But over the past year, our budget is stable. We're meeting our needs. We're able to pay the bills and you know, a couple of minor things, which would be insurance going up because we acquired a lot of infrastructure. Went up considerably. Safety equipment, a few things that we're purchasing for the sake of the employees has changed things. But beyond that, again, it's a learning process too. Being somewhat fairly new in the way we're growing, we over time we establish history and again staff and modernization and other things start to build history, and we're able to fine-tune the budget. We're getting to that point. I think we're pretty accurate. We're seeing our percentages of our expenses and our income and expenses are matching very closely with the time and year that we're at. And so we feel like we've got pretty good control of the budget with a little bit of a surplus that can start to set aside so that the district has a reserve in case of critical things going wrong or a bad economy or something, that they can pay the bills, especially the bonds. You have to have reserves for those bonds to make sure that you have at least a year's coverage on them.
Okay. Well, that's a good introduction and overview, and thank you, Roy.
Yeah.
The tentative budget is available on the website, so if our guests are interested in looking at that and reviewing that at their leisure and have questions, comments, or concerns, feel free to contact Roy or Carrie or me, or for that matter, any board member. We're always open and willing and capable of discussing issues as critically important as our budgetary process. So do any of our guests have any questions about the budget? In the absence of reviewing it, I would suggest that that might be premature.
No.
Hearing no questions. Okay, let's move on to our proposed new rate schedule of fees for 2023. Gary, are you able to screen share those, or are we going to defer to the...
There it is, Bob.
And again, Carrie, I'll ask you just to kind of highlight the tabular nature of this. Essentially, there has been a persistent increase in our user fees across all payer categories and across all years. And it's an anticipated curve of cost increases to end users that we'd like to bend and diminish the cost increases. But this is our projected cost and fee structure across all payer categories.
Yes. You'll notice that this is starting with concurrent of 2021 going through 2029. This is proposed for this. This rate sheet is done with the Capital's Facilities Plan and the IFFP. And we do have a gentleman that comes in, you know, there's a rate structure that he has to go by depending on how we do our, depending on how the Capital's Facilities Plan is set up. Just like Bob said, it will go up continuously. But as of right now, the proposed rate is for the water base fee, which you're paying right now, $124.93, it'll go up to $156.16. And then there's the tier. So you've got 5,000 gallons a month that you could, you know, up to 5,000. At 5,001 to 10,000, it will go up $15.61 per 1,000 gallons. So every 1,000. And then once you get to 10,000 and over, it's it'll be $31.23 for every 1,000 over that. And then a standby fee is just a basic $124.92. So for sewer, it's the same thing. Your basic sewer rate, it goes from $66.85 to $68.85. Your standby fee goes from $60.16 to $61.97. So basically, it's your water that's really going to be the substantial change.
Okay. So how did we decide on these fees, Carrie? Do we just make these numbers up and hope for the best?
No, like I said, they go hand in hand with the Capital's Facilities Plan. So there is a gentleman that we hire that does our rate study that it goes by the Capital's Facilities Plan itself and the information that is given to him with the engineer. And then he goes through and he does the study. He does the calculations based off of our budget, based off of our Capital's Plan, what has to happen with the Capital Plan. And he calculates the rates. And this is what he comes up with. Now, we will be having, like I said, you'll notice on part of your agenda down there, we'll, you know, with the Capital's Facilities Plan. The Capital's Facilities Plan basically gets done for a five-year time frame, which is basically what he's got right here. Within the time of your, he takes it out a little bit farther. But these are rates that are done with the study alongside with the Capital's Plan. And then when we have any funding that has to be done, when we fund, we go out for bonds, we go out for grants or anything like that. This is all, they will go by these rates. They will go by what we have in the CAPS plan and the impact fees. So this is done. This is not something that we do. This is actually hired out.
Okay. Do any board members want to expand on this?
Yeah, I think it's
important to understand that the capital facilities plan has to anticipate any bonds required for any of the projects that are in the foreseeable future. And in those bond payments, the bond issuers require to have the business plan essentially, and to know where our rates are headed, and to build those in. This is how these plans come together. So it's a pretty complex piece of work that goes into this, and a lot of board member input over the entire year. So to get to this point, I'm really proud of our team, and we've done I think a pretty good job of riding the ship and moving us in the right direction. So,
well, thanks, Bob. Any other board members want to expand or comment on our rate structure?
I think I will, Mr. Chair. Interestingly enough, any persons anywhere in our district do not pay for water. They only pay for the delivery system of that water. But the water is included. The delivery system is what the charges are for. So all the infrastructure surrounding that. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, Jim. Turning to our guest, it's never good news from home to say that the rates are going up for the foreseeable future, but it's a simple reality. We're a small district with a limited customer base and high intensity costs. Do any of our guests have any questions about the specific rate structures anticipated? Well, thank you. Okay. Let's go ahead and move on to item number three of the business items, proposed fine of $1,000 for water shutoff due to irrigation. Let me set the stage for this. Our district has recently, and actually proudly, instituted a no irrigation policy within our district. We sit at the top of a mountain with very limited water resources. In fact, there's a single well right now that's servicing our entire district. We anticipate by the end of the year we will be able to introduce additional source to support our district. Those resources are finite. And it's boiling down to a lot of ways that in order to protect this finite resource, we need to make informed decisions on how we're going to use that the water. Allowing irrigation within our district increases the demand on our sources and over time limits development. There's only so many gallons per minute coming out of that hidden lake well. The state itself has statutory fixed requirements on how many gallons per minute is required to service any given ERU. Developer at the top of the hill is limited by those constraints. So water that is being used for irrigation limits that development. And our district made a very concerted effort to put together a no irrigation policy. We feel it promotes conservation and community spirit. And we feel it protects an essential resource at this point in time. And we included in that policy was an attempt to put some enforcement teeth in it. The policy itself, if you haven't read it, calls for two separate notifications of violation. In other words, getting caught using potable culinary water for irrigation purposes, followed by a fine mechanism. So the point of discussion tonight is not whether the district has a commitment to stick to a no irrigation policy, but whether or not the fine mechanism makes sense within the constructs of serving our customers. And most importantly, we're looking for feedback from our customers. How do we ensure that you have water to drink, water to bathe, water to flush your toilet? How do we ensure that the developer has water and yet allow what would seem to be open-ended, unregulated irrigation? So I'll turn it over to the group now. I would ask Roy to expand on those comments if possible so we can further set the stage of what drove the initiation of this policy.
All right, thanks. Well, One of the biggest challenges, of course, is what Bob mentioned, is the Hidden Lake Well is the water right is for municipal use inside of the house. And so a limited amount of water can be pulled from that well at 120 gallons a minute. And of course, the development was designed for that as well as the water right. So if irrigation expands on that, we start impeding on somebody else's water right. And so then it starts to create all kinds of legal problems. The other challenges that have to be paid for and fought, which you as a group will have to pay for. So that's when we start looking like, wow, we can't do this. And how do we, if it continues to happen, how do we protect the group or the district? The other challenge is if everybody says, oh, I want to irrigate no matter what, then you say, okay, let's go develop more water. Well, the next sources are probably about $7 to $10 million to get for irrigation. So your rates are going to go through the roof if we decide, as you decided as a group, to do that. So you're going to have to make a choice. And the problem is those are the end results of whatever choice you make. And if people don't go along with it or choose not to, or you chose to do something different as a group, or somebody decides to go outside of that decision, they'll impose costs on the rest of the group. And how do you curtail that? And that's what it's really all about. How do you make it fair for everybody else that owns the system? And as part of the team or part of the group, if somebody else utilizes the resources, irrigation could take up the potential development of several other homes. So again, the state does not anticipate irrigation. They don't allow it under our water right. So that creates another big challenge. And again, that'll be a big fight legally. Water right wise, and also for the sake of monitoring and everything else that goes along with engineering costs. So it's a very serious reality that the district as a whole is going to have to deal with the fact that you don't have water for irrigation, and especially long term, and that you're gonna have to make a choice if you want to develop it. It's very costly. And if you want to do it illegally, then it's very costly.
Would other board members want to comment on this? We work this issue very diligently. Rob, Bob, Jim, Ron Wilson.
Yeah, let me just say that the people that have senior water rights would immediately complain and probably take legal action against us if we did any sort of irrigation on the mount. It doesn't preclude, though, individuals from capturing water off their roofs and building a cistern or a storage capability of their own and pumping it as it becomes available. But right now, we absolutely do not have the water to support it.
Jim, Bob, Rob.
Oh, you know, I have nothing to add.
You're muted.
Covered it all.
Bob Bingham, you're muted.
As you say, we've worked it really hard. I mean, it's been a challenge based on what the developers told homeowners, and as I've expressed to our board members, the anticipation was that people would be able to start or restart growth around their properties after construction. And it's become untenable, it was a piece of I think it was in the original design guidelines for the Summit Powder Mountain project that was never approved by the board, that this rumor started that people couldn't do that. The board actually never voted on or allowed any outdoor irrigation on the mountain. So really, this is a reiteration of the policy that already exists. And unfortunately, I think it's something that we're going to have to stick with, especially considering the environment we're in now.
I think everything I want to point out too, that we're also following state code as well. So everything's been well said. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
What do our guests think of this? There's obviously some contentious. John?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We do have some concerns about this. I guess first of all, what I'd like to say is when you all describe this as the problem as being long-term, open-ended, unregulated irrigation, I'd have to agree for obvious reasons. It's that we have a scarce resource and we have to husband it. But I think maybe that's the problem, is this defining the worst-case scenario leads to a total ban on any irrigation. And I believe that is too broad. In your conservation plan, there's a statement that native plants don't require irrigation. And that's true for native plants that have been growing there for hundreds of years. They have a deep root structure that survives drought. But it's completely untrue for replanting and reestablishing new grasses on a construction site after you've scraped the soil on the construction site. So the problem is, you literally can't plant anything new without some minor level of irrigation. So, and I think any arborist or landscaper would tell you the same thing. So for new construction projects, what we'd like to propose is certainly not long-term, open-ended, unregulated irrigation, but instead, for new construction on the mountain, I think a more sane balance would be temporary restricted irrigation for construction projects, limited to two seasons only, combined with monthly restrictions that follow the Weber Basin's advice in those summer months, which of course this last summer were two waterings per week for 20 minutes each. So that would be our suggestion. Now, along with that, I think there's a better way to measure the use of water by construction projects. Right now, what we're doing is we're looking at those four irrigation months, and we're going, oh my God, that's an insane amount of water that's being used. But if you look at a construction project, from the moment we get a building permit, we start paying for 5,000 gallons of water per month. However, we're using 0 gallons of water per month. So what we propose there is that for a construction project, you basically keep account of the water not used, and you balance that against the irrigation water that's used in those 4 months. In Barbara's and my particular case with our lot 29, we've had an unusually long construction process because of COVID. But as a result of that, we have two seasons of where we've used water for irrigation. But since we took our building permit in 2018, we have 46 months where we paid for water but didn't use any, for a total of 245,000 gallons. So to us, it would simply make sense to balance the water we've paid for but haven't used against that water we used during those 4 months. So that's our suggestion. Somewhere, I think all or nothing almost never works out for people. I think there is a minor measured compromise that well worth considering. So thank you for your time. I'll turn this over to our attorney, Nikki, because we, of course, have concerns about these associated penalty fees as well.
Thank you, John. And just to, to follow up on some of the comments that John's made, and also let me just be clear also that we represent Barbara Kerr also, who is a owner with John, and also John Browning and Diane Browning, who are co-owners of Lot 29, and Plunkett's also on Lot 84. And the first issue, as John mentioned, is with the fees, this penalty fee for irrigation use. And the problem with that fee as proposed is that it's frankly just illegal. The Utah Code, Section 17B1-121, requires all fees that are imposed by a service district like this one to reflect only the reasonable estimated cost of delivering the service for which the fee was paid. So if shutting off the water would reasonably cost the district $1,000, then that would bear a reasonable relation to it. But because it really is just an arbitrary amount that's been set in order to, you know, I think it, as was said at the August meeting, to make sure that, that the wealthy landowners don't just ignore it. That may or may not be true that they do that. It may or may not be a good policy, but regardless, it just doesn't comply with Utah law. Utah law, it's got to reflect the reasonable estimated cost. It doesn't. It's just a punitive measure to try to force compliance. But regardless, as I mentioned, it's illegal under the governing statutes. So that's the first issue with this fee. The second issue goes more to the policy, which I understand isn't directly on the agenda tonight, but it is certainly tied up to this fee issue. And that is, as I think everyone has mentioned, there are these homeowners, lot owners up in this area, who not only were required by the developer and the design guidelines, as you mentioned, to have irrigation systems and to install landscaping, but were also required to do so by Weber County in order to get their building permits. They were required to submit detailed plans of both the landscaping and the irrigation, and then those plans were submitted, they were approved, and the building pit permits were issued. And in reliance on those building permits and the vested rights that go with them, you know, these lot owners like Mr. Plunkett spend a lot of money installing irrigation systems and planting trees and shrubbery and, you know, native things and water-wise things, very much so, but still doing that, only then to be told, well, not only you know, do you not have the right to do it, but you can't do it, notwithstanding the rights that you were given by Weber County. So that's a real concern, and I think, as Mr. Plunkett mentioned, very supportive of conservation efforts and water-wise irrigation and native landscaping and all of that. But it's not an all or nothing situation where we don't, you know, we don't have much water, and so we're going to prohibit all irrigation, and that the only alternative to that is to allow unlimited irrigation. There are a lot of options in the middle, hopefully. And especially where we have their fire issues up on the mountain, and when you don't restore the native vegetation, then the weeds come in that are flammable and can easily catch fire and spark. So just would encourage some more consideration about that. As far as the water rights go, that's certainly not an issue that I've looked into as to specifically what water rights you have and what they encompass, but it would be very unusual if you have water rights for residential use for that not to encompass some outdoor use irrigation, as opposed to irrigation for farming and something like that. Sometimes those words are used interchangeably, but they aren't really the same thing. And certainly you don't have the right to have farmers up there irrigating, but it would be unusual to not have some right to some outdoor irrigation for homeowners if they have rights to use the water for residential use. But again, that's not an issue I've looked at specific to this, and just responding to some of the comments there. I think another point that Mr. Plunkett has, I know, made with me and would like to make with you is that we appreciate, again, that the resources may be scarce, but we're unaware of any other service district or a governmental entity that completely prohibits irrigation by its residents. And even though, again, resources can be scarce everywhere, and to find some sort of compromise that would allow those that have invested a lot of time and money and effort in landscaping and irrigation systems and purchasing of their lots and reliance on a lot of these issues as well, to be able to reestablish stuff and vegetation for the benefit of the entire mountain would be a reasonable compromise on that. Just thank you again for your work on the board. We know that it's a thankless job, but we do appreciate it and appreciate the opportunity to comment.
Well, thank you.
Just to kind of build on what, hey, I'm Ray, by the way. I'm the new owner at Lot 30. They just finished pouring our foundation, so I'm real new to the whole situation. But I have to kind of build on what John said. I used to have to do LEED projects for environmental certification, and one of the things that was a big deal was, of course, the vegetation and the natural vegetation and temporary irrigation. I think something that's, if you look at the big picture, putting a native vegetation back in where it was scraped around the foundation and was trampled on during the equipment, you know, in the long term, it actually reduces the amount of evaporation. It helps the environment. It actually reduces the amount of water that is used around the environment. I don't have any proposal to put in a lawn. I'm not into any of the lawn, but I would like to put the native vegetation back around my house so that not only does it reduce the use of water and evaporation, but it also keeps down the erosion. There is going to be a lot of erosion if we're not able to put back some of that native vegetation over there, especially where, you know, places like the Overlook where the lots are really tiny, you got a ton of building, they're going to be all connected. One, there's going to be a lot of open ground that if you just let it, you know, be bare ground, it's just going to erode. It's going to have a lot of erosion out there. So that's my big concern too is, you know, I don't know if that's been factored into the big picture. I mean, I'm from the desert. I'm from Nevada. So we don't use any water as we can here. But, you know, up there, I would at least like to have the opportunity to put back the native shrubs that were around my house that is just now removed. So that's all I wanted to say.
Well, thank you. And welcome.
Yeah, thanks.
Built your house. There's a lot of snow right now.
Yeah.
Welcome. Okay. Do any other of our guests on this particular point have any comments, questions, concerns, anything they want to expand, revisit? John, you look like you're interested in saying something else.
Yeah, actually, I wanted to speak to Bob Bingham's point, comment earlier. He referred to rumors that there were some regulations or requirements regarding all this. I just wanted to tell you all that if both the 2013 and 2014 design guidelines have quite a bit of requirements in them regarding irrigation. And in particular, I want to draw your attention to a section called Wildlife Safety Measures. I don't know if you can see this on the screen. Probably not. I'll send you a copy of this. At any rate, what it tells homeowners is safety standards to follow as preventative measures against wildfire, and then 3D is the instruction to maintain an irrigated area. I think my biggest concern up there is the landscape that has gotten taken out by the road cuts, and my biggest worry is a truck making a spark, catching the grass at the bottom of my property on fire. So actually the majority of my irrigation did not go to my property. It went to the city, or rather the county right-of-way, trying to make that right-of-way safe again. And I'm happy to say after 2 years of giving an irrigation, I believe it's now healthy and it's less of a fire hazard. I also want to point out, this is not all in the past. If you go to the current design guidelines on the Powder Mountain website, you'll find the same wildlife safety measure requiring homeowners to maintain an irrigated area. So I would hope that you all take that into account along with our suggestion to look for a minor compromise for temporary irrigation for construction projects. But thank you all very much for your time. I realize this is a lot of hard work for everybody involved, and I appreciate it.
Well, thank you, John. You know, we're not tone deaf to your concerns. It's quite literally a choice. Do you want additional neighbors, additional ERUs approved for development? Do you want water for your house? Do you want water security? Or do you want native vegetation next to your house that you irrigate? It's very difficult. And I got to tell you, we ran into this conversation to encourage people through the planning process with the county to submit plans for irrigation systems. They're not required by county regulations to have irrigation. The county just reviews what you put on your plan, I believe. So once those irrigation systems are approved and installed, it becomes, in my mind, an unregulatable situation. People are going to do what they want to do when they want to do it. And we feel that it's best if we intercede and prevent the installation of systems, encourage cistern systems as an alternative, and to be stewards of this very precious resource and to allow further development. The very first gallon of additional source that comes out of Cache County costs $7 to $10 million. The very first gallon, okay? The developer has arguably a responsibility to develop Bloomington well, but that's been senescent for 3 years and unproven. We're adding additional source. This is literally whether or not you are subject to an evacuation order because of lack of water. So we don't think this something can be easily regulated, and we've looked at this extensively. So we appreciate your suggestions, your compromises, the pushback on the fine, whatever. But we're working on your behalf. That's all I can say. Rob Cabot, please.
Yeah, I would just like to let the public members here know that we had, as a board, these detailed discussions. We reviewed all of these issues closely, and we eventually came to a consensus and an agreement. But we had a lot of varying opinions. We understand the issues up there on top of Powder Mountain. Three of us, you know, live on top of Powder Mountain. We're fully aware of what's going on around us. We know about noxious weeds. We know about erosion. We know about fire risks. We know about the aesthetics of this whole situation. And we, you know, at length discussed this, and we came down with the facts presented to us by the state and the county and our situation with water rights and our single source of a well. And we realized we have no alternative but to make this policy. And we didn't go into it lightly. As I said, we reviewed a lot of these concerns, and we found ourselves with no other option. And so your comments are not falling on deaf ears. We had extensive discussions about this and really reviewed stuff about, you know, state statutes of whether we were able to put these kinds of penalties in this and so forth. And this is where we came to. And it pains us at the same time, because we know what we're all faced with here. So it wasn't easy.
Jim, you had something to say? I couldn't tell.
I appreciate very much Mr. Plunkett's argument. Isn't it? It's wonderful, though, that the district is operating better today than they did in 2014 and 15 when those guidelines first came out. Quite a bit better. Bob and I, we can attest to that. And so we improve and we are more responsible. I think in my short tenure here, it's only 6 years, the district's running better today than it ever has. It's more responsible with everything that's going on. So. These are tough decisions, but the fact of the matter is, I appreciate what he said. He's got some good points, but the fact of the matter is we have water for people in use, or we have water for everything. So,
just so that I'm clear, the only time that you can legally irrigate landscaping per your current requirements is if you have a cistern system and you pump it to your irrigation. Is that correct?
Jim?
Mr. Chair, that has to do with, I wish I could tell you for Nikki DeForge, it's on, there is a state statute that it now allows, that was not in place back in 14 and 15, but that's something that's come about in the last 2 or 3 years that allows you to collect the water off your structure, put it in some kind of a bucket, barrel, cistern, or whatever, to use that ground applied. But that's a state statute that's just recently come about.
Okay, so theoretically, if a person had that in their house, they're using that to water their irrigation, how would you know they're using that system and not portable water?
Meters.
The meters would react to, okay, they're that sensitive to handle that, okay?
Yeah, actually, Ray, we had that exact situation where we were using the cistern water, and somebody saw our sprinklers going and spread the alarm that we were irrigating. So actually that can and does happen. We have a cistern that holds 5,000 gallons, and what we try to do is empty it before every storm so that we recapture the next 5,000.
Good. That's great. Okay. Well,
point of information, 5,000 gallon tank?
Right.
Wow. I've put in a lot of stuff. I've never seen 5,000. 1,500 is as big as I've seen. Thank you.
This is a concrete tank that's underground.
How does that work, John? Has it been successful? Do you think it's something that would be good for the homeowners up there, or what do you think about it?
Yeah, it's in the design guidelines. We basically tried to do everything the design guidelines proposed back in the day. Everybody knows, we're not talking about this, but everybody knows that there is, you know, the master developer up there completely failed in their responsibilities. They should be at this meeting. They should be leading this whole discussion. Too bad they don't take their responsibilities. But if I were that master developer, I'd be requiring a homeowner to include a rainwater capture system. It's just
great idea, John.
Just makes sense. If you did that along with this temporary irrigation, I think you'd have a very good balance that would survive legal challenge. So that's another reason we're recommending you consider it that way.
I think there's this is kind of where Brad would be really helpful, but you know, Brad had a really, our chief engineer has a really good sort of analogy of where we are on the mountain. And I think it's important for us to understand this. We are on an island, and the only water that we have right now is coming from a single well. And we can't, if we run out of water, if there's a problem with the well, if there's anything problem with any of the connections to any of our homes, it's game over. We have to evacuate and we have to move people off the mountain. That goes for the entire ski area as well. So it's not a small problem to have. And I think, you know, if you're down in the valley, and John mentioned the guidelines for down the valley for watering twice a week, every one of those systems down in the valley are all interconnected. So if one water district runs out of water in the reservoir, they can call up the neighboring district and they can turn a couple valves and they can get some water. It might cost them some money, but they are physically connected. So there is some redundancy with those systems. We don't have that. We are literally all by ourselves on top of a mountain. And I think that really brought it home for me on what's at stake on the mountain. And I think it's important for us to understand that until we get a second source. I don't think it's a little irresponsible for us to worry about trees at the moment, I guess. And that's kind of, I think, where we've come down. And it sucks because I have trees that are dying right next to my house.
I would phrase it differently. I would say worry about fire. I think that's the bigger issue, Bob.
Yeah, I mean.
Well, no vegetation is a good thing. In fire prevention, have a defensible perimeter around your home of no vegetation. I live on the hill as well. I'm intimately familiar with how vegetation develops here. I didn't plant anything. I come back every season and there's native grass all over my property from seeds that germinate and take advantage of spring rains. I do.
Yeah, we've done a lot of weeding over the last 2 years, incredible amount of weeds that come up in the soil that's been disturbed.
Yeah. And so, well, I think this discussion has been useful, and we'll take your positions into account, John and Nikki.
Thank you.
I just got to share something with you here. You know, when we start talking about legal challenges and all these sorts of things, every legal issue that occurs in our district requires us to spin up our attorney. Okay? Those costs associated with spinning up our attorney are directly passed on to the entire customer base. It's much better if we can have open-ended, frank, and conversations and come to agreements as a community in spinning up legal resources. Por favor.
Agreed.
Okay. So I think we've reached a point where we can possibly move on to the next topic, if that's okay with the group. Is everybody okay? Nikki, Dason, Ashley? Sounds like a plan. Okay. Okay, so we're on item B, business items. Proposed revised merchant fee of 3.6%. Carrie, can you walk us through this issue?
Absolutely. When somebody uses a debit or a credit card to make a payment, there is a processing fee that we are charged through QuickBooks. Now that fee has gone down. The original fee through the end that we were charging was 5%, which is what we were charged to process your card. QuickBooks has since then reduced the fee, which means we will be reducing the fee also. So that fee will be reduced from 5 to 3.6%.
Okay. Board members want to comment on this, and then our guests? Good news. If you want miles on your credit card. Do any of our guests object to us reducing our...
The only fee that's going down, but hey, we got one fee.
we're working for you, man. Okay. Let's talk now about business item number five, proposed fine of $5,000 for unauthorized water turn on. Roy, tell us under what circumstances might even be applicable, please.
Yeah, so this is after after somebody's been notified, the water's been turned off, and we're gonna have to go back and revisit this whole situation after a couple of interactions with the customers. And so probably rarely would happen. Most people would probably respond and deal with this, but if not, then there would be costs included in it. The costs would probably entail legal interaction, my guess is, and that's part of what drove those considerations on the numbers, is if you start dragging an attorney in to have a conversation with the neighbor, it's going to get expensive real fast. And the employees coming up there to turn the water on or off or any of that kind of stuff gets expensive, and any legal notices and stuff. So all that's what starts to create a problem, and that's where the numbers came from. Now, you know, we could consider something differently, I guess, but that's something you'll have to think about. It may be just a legal challenge that you might take them to court over.
Okay. Yeah,
it was trying, hopefully, to dissuade that.
So this is somebody that's had their water turned off per policy and goes out with a crescent wrench and turns it back on themselves.
Yeah.
That's what we're talking about.
Probably rare that will happen.
Any board members want to expand upon this issue? Any guests? Hearing no additional comment. Okay, let's move on to our business item number six. It's a notification from your district that we intend to review our current capital facility plan. Roy, can you lead out on this? This is a work in progress. This is a big deal for our district, our capital facility plan. We need to match what our anticipated facilities needs would be with our anticipated customer growth, cost it out, and make it work.
Yeah, and as Carrie mentioned earlier, and she was talking about some of the fees, that we have to do this every 5 years anyway. And we're getting to that point, but it's driven somewhat by growth and change in the development and how the district expands and requests for services and all kinds of things. And so we're at that point where we need to take a look at it. And so as we do, then of course we'll look at bonding costs, infrastructure that needs modernization of anything that has to happen, and how all that's going to be dealt with, whether it's a something the district as a whole needs to do, or is something that a developer will need to do based on the engineer's recommendations. And so they will look at all of the needs of the district as an engineer. This is really not driven by us as staff or board members. They'll have a chance to comment, but this is based on solid engineering professionals who review the current requirements of the state, both water and sewer, and to look at what types of infrastructure needs to be built or what's failing and what needs to be expanded or whatever, extensions need to be made, whatever, in order to accommodate growth and accommodate deficiencies in the system. And then they'll cost those out. And then based on the number of customers that participate, based on the cost of bonding, based on the cost of the pieces of infrastructure and what pieces the district pays for and what pieces the development pays for, all those are factored into a rate. So we have to notify the public that we're going to start this so that you know, and so you know that it's going to affect you and anybody else that's involved. It affects your life and possibly what you're going to pay as an impact fee. And so our hopes, of course, is not to jack impact fees up to high amounts, but they've gone up substantially. But a lot of that's driven by the cost of, as you've seen, homes and infrastructure. Just a valve that goes inside one of these pump houses is $10,000. A meter is $10,000. So you can imagine if you've got multiple of those and miles of pipe, we're in a very remote location, and treatments clear down in the valley, new treatment facilities are several million dollars. The wells, as we just heard, are tens of millions of dollars. Tanks are millions of dollars. In order to pay for whatever portion the district has to, and or a developer has to pay, or a new homeowner has to pay as their piece of the new infrastructure, those all get factored into the number of people that are participating and the developments and the district boundaries. And so the district looks at all that, and the board members look at where they're going to go, and engineers look at how all this is going to come together, and then they divide that up and look at rates and bonding and create spreadsheets, and that all ends up being the number at the end. And so we have to do statutorily, and again, it has to go through a vetting process and reviews and everything else, and people who review the financials of the district and the numbers, and not just something we would choose. And the money is used for the infrastructure. It's not used for the operation of the district. It's used for your customers.
Yeah, it's an exercise that we're aggressively looking at, because it helps us work with developers to help them understand what the requirements are for their development as we plan out what we think the capacities need to be and the storage requirements and the water rights and all these things. And then we stand by that plan, and it represents a springboard for protecting your investment and servicing your homes. Do any board members have any want to expand on that? Roy, you hit that hard, man. That was good.
And by the way, we will be open for some discussion and further review, and you're more than welcome to contact us and ask any questions you want about where it's at, what it's looking like, and why the engineers are doing what they're doing. And it does affect your life if you're especially a new homeowner.
Anybody want to expand on that? This is just a notification that we're reviewing this right now.
Yeah, Bernard, I'd love to add something in if I could.
Andrew, hi.
Yes. I know some of you. I don't know all of you. Yeah, just to make a couple comments on Roy's comments there, that hit some great points. I manage several properties up at Powder Mountain, and I know what life is like up there, and respect everything that you all are dealing with, and admire everything that you're doing to make it all possible, because it is truly a unique place that is absolutely insane right now, as far as the winter goes, as far as snow goes, as far as what's going on up there right now. I've had issues with the water main actually freezing, and it's a pretty major deal, because, as you know, I mean, a lot of these homeowners that are up there, are up there during the winter season when it's ski season, and that's why they have a home on the top of Powder Mountain. You have rare few who spend the year up there, which is awesome, but most of them are up there during the winter. And I've experienced a couple situations last year where the water main actually froze and I lost water to one of the properties that I manage. And as a property manager, that's a significant issue. And I've talked with Roy about it, and just wanted to kind of put it on the table as to what the thoughts were on you know, what we can do to prevent that moving forward.
Right.
Yeah, so a couple of things. Of course, our engineers have looked at that extensively. Our new standard, of course, is 9 feet in the ground now. That was not the case when the development was built. Not sure why, but also the services are also to be insulated and to have heat tape on them, especially if they're not deep enough. And if a new home goes in, that's something that should be happening with the brand new service going in. And that gives you a couple of things, protection. The insulation only protects you for a short period of time because you're just fighting Mother Nature as it continues to chill even the insulation and get to the pipe. Some water trickling, it literally just has to be a little bit, will keep it from freezing. It's been pretty much proven. That's critical. Now, Andrew, I don't remember all of the properties you have, but
we met down on the circle, down on the circle on 8452, I believe it was.
Oh, down the street park.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, you're right across from Bob's house, I believe.
Right? Exactly. So, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Those are, of course, those are already in, and we had a problem with the one house, and I think it's because the way our service was installed is fairly shallow. Probably have to, any further problems have to be taken out and reinstalled, my guess is, and insulated with heat tape.
Right. So understood. That's my point. Is that's a pretty major undertaking, and that's going to take you know, significant dollars and significant time to do. And we are approaching winter, so I mean, how do I mitigate that situation for one, and then two is the other properties that may have had those water lines installed prior to that further depth. Was it 9 feet? Did you say 9 feet?
Yep.
What happens to all of those other properties that had that exact same thing done before the 9 foot policy? How does that impact them?
So far, a lot of them we haven't seen that much trouble with. We did fix the ones up on Ridge Nest, next to Summit, and their team went back in and relayed that line, insulated it, fixed the one Gail and Sue's place. This year, we'll see how that pans out. And you know, we put in bleeder valves, which should help keep water moving. The warmth of the water coming out of the earth actually helps a lot. The water doesn't seem to freeze in the mains if it's 5 or 6 feet deep. The water over there, it was only about 36 inches, so it was just too shallow. But if the we call it the witching hour, it appears to be sometime after January that the frost starts to get down in the ground and it works its way down. And again, if you're starting to get those times of year, if you just turn on a drip, it doesn't have to be much at all, and leave it dripping, we anticipate there'll be some that happening during the year and we're planning on it, but it will keep them from freezing. It's when everybody turns off the water after it's been running, freezes every time. So if you're gonna be there, just leave a little bit dripping. It'll
right. Right. Understood completely, and I respect that. And here we are talking about water conservation.
Yeah.
So I'm a little bit, you know, what your drip is may be a little bit different than what I think a drip is, and how much water that can use. We can table that for now. But Bernard, back to the fact of what we're talking about of irrigation, and the word on the street up in at the top of the mountain was that in new construction you are allowed to have water drip line to new vegetation for 2 years.
Yeah, so that's the thing, very thing we've been discussing earlier, is that we can't allow anything, but that the group has been, as Mr. Plunkett is saying, that they've got to have some vegetation. It's a policy the board has set that there is going to be no outside irrigation based on the water right and the ability to supply that. The cost is, means you're going to have to go to Cache County or maybe down in Pineview and run up an irrigation system to the top of the mountain for several million dollars.
Right.
So the reality is it's probably not going to ever happen. And there is a possibility of cisterns working. And then the board's going to have to decide how they want to deal with it. If they're going to allow any kind of water use, right now they're saying no. Maybe there's some compromise, I don't know. That's just up to the board members.
That's great information. But I think the important thing is that the rumor on the mountain.
Those rumors are actually in their real estate documents.
Okay, so they're not rumor. They're facts. It's factual data. But my point is that these homeowners have invested significant amount of money in these trees, in this vegetation, in trying to do all the things that John said earlier, trying to get things back to where they were before they disturbed the soil. In an effort to be good, people that go supporting what they're trying to make the property look like, and the fact that if they can't water it, we need to make that very clear to them up front. And I'm with all of you. I live here. I live in Utah. I understand what our water problems are, and we just have to be clear about that up front and not tell these people to spend $70,000-$100,000 on trees to plant that they're going to be able to water for 2 years. Because right. If they don't water for 2 years, I know firsthand they will not live. I've had 27 trees die on me because I followed the rules, which I thought I was supposed to follow, and they all died.
mine are dead. right across the street. You know, the that's just a frustrating part about the whole thing is the building envelope. The builders are going way past the building envelope and scraping all the land, right? Because they need room for construction, or they need access, or they need something. And this is what we've been fighting for, is I would love to be able to re-vegetate all of that somehow. And the only thing that seems to be the only option for us at the moment is to do the cistern idea. But the whole rule around what you have to sort of realize is that this isn't the right thing, but the design guideline that Summit sends out, they're the master developer, and they're saying one thing. We're the water district, and we have a fiduciary duty to deliver water, and we can't do that, with a straight face if we're allowing people to irrigate. We don't have the source. So we're saying, sorry, that whatever's in your design guideline is trumped by this entity, which is called the Powder Mountain Water and Sewer Board. So the two-year rule is now out the window. There is no more 2 years to irrigate.
So that's what's been going on, is this discussion, these plans, and limiting it. You know, once the board approves all this stuff, then the notices to us, and they have been, to Summit, as a developer, we're not going to allow it. And it'll be the same thing. County will have to get their support on approving plans that they're in this district, at least on top of the mountain, that there's no outside irrigation, or we require cisterns or something like that. But something definitely's got to change.
Just to kind of add it, you guys all know this, and this is going to sound pretentious, but I'm just going to say it because I'm not in this league. But you guys are talking about one drop of water, if you have to go extra, is going to cost $7 million, right? Just realize that $7 million is 2.5 houses at Powder Mountain. Yeah. That's the financial reality up there. So, you guys might be in for one hell of a fight because of that. You know, if a person's spending millions of dollars and they can't reestablish the vegetation around their house, I mean, it's kind of, we're kind of like, well, what the hell? I just throw it out there.
It's a great point.
Yeah.
Yes, we're fully aware of this. As I said earlier, we have discussed these issues. We're completely aware of it, and it's extremely frustrating for us as a board. And what we're dealing with is a developer of Summit that is not really paying attention and not working well with others to try and work through some of these issues. And we feel your pain. Like I said earlier, three of us are landowners up there and live up there, and we have these same frustrations that you fellows are speaking of right now. And we too feel great frustration around it because we're not getting the kind of support from the developer to work through these issues. And this is just one of them. We're struggling with many, many, many issues that we have with this developer. And we're not getting very far. And so that's all we can say. We hear you. We share your pain.
Yeah. You know, your developer can go to Cache County, obtain water rights, and construct a pipe and provide additional storage, and you guys can grow watercress.
Good one. Yeah, that's not going to happen. So,
no.
Is there anyone from the Summit Group on this call?
Okay.
Yes. Sorry, this is Jason. I just barely started working for them a couple weeks ago, so be nice. But yeah, I am here to try and solve these issues, and Roy and I have worked together trying to solve these issues, so I'm listening and I'm hearing, and actually it's my job to actually go in and review these design guidelines, so I love hearing this feedback. Just get my hands dirty a little bit. So I'd love to meet with the board and give you guys that. I am sitting as their head of strategic real estate. So all of this is so important to hear. And anybody who wants to talk and meet, I'm totally open. Like this, I'm very different. So I want to win-win. So
that's what we need, Jason.
We've met Jason.
You're right here first. It's so awesome.
So I'm here, I'm listening. So I'm just getting diving into this. So I'm only two cool. weeks in. So give me some time. But anybody that would like to check out, I'm very happy to. I live in Huntsville. I'm in the Valley. So I'm happy to meet with anybody and the board. I'd love to sit down and chat more. We've met before, but love to.
Yeah.
I wasn't in this fashion. So
you were with me, right?
Still in, yeah, on their dev side, but I...
We met at a meeting at the county pre-COVID.
We did. I'm passionate about with everything that's going on up there, and I felt a duty to raise my hand and say, hey, guys, I think we can do this better. And so I raised my hand and said, hey, can I help get some things straight? And they said yes. So anyways, yeah, I'm here and I'm listening, so... Appreciate all the comments.
Terrific, Jason. Okay.
Yeah, Jim Harvey had his hand up there.
Jim.
I just wanted to, Mr. Chair, and to the rest of you listening and board members and guests, I could speak to Mr. Johnson's integrity and his genuine ability to be able to do good things for these kind of developments. But we have confidence in his ability, and I just wanted to throw that in because he's done everything he said he's going to do when he says he's going to do it, and that is a positive move forward for those who chose Mr. Johnson in this role for that group up there. I think we're finally going to see some good things coming through for on that development side. So he's here on his own time. Listening in and trying to learn, that speaks right there. And the fact that he was stood up and said, okay, fire the bullets, but go easy on me, you know, maybe don't sight rifle, but just wanted to, he's a good dude. That's all. Thanks.
I appreciate that, Jim. No, I appreciate that. And sorry my camera's not on. I'm taking the family down to St. George right now, so you wouldn't be able to see me anyways. Yeah. But yeah, thanks, Jim. Appreciate that.
Okay. Well, this has been a good dialogue. We're at the end, it seems like, of our business items, but does anybody else have anything they want to talk about right now within this context? We're open for Roy, myself, any of our board members. Reach out if there's... Andrew, you had something you wanted to bring up?
Yeah, when will these... I obviously know you guys have very smart water meters on all of your water systems up there. When are these... When are you going to start restricting this water if there was a trickle system, drip system installed back when the rule said you could install a drip system? I mean, obviously we're going into winter, so it's not an issue, but when is the water cops going to be coming out on this?
We passed a no irrigation policy.
Right. So when can I expect my clients to be receiving a bill that says you use too much water?
Good question, Chair. Period.
Yeah. The meters have been in place since July. So if there was an overage at that from July until now, they would have already received one. And if you you as the property management, if you would like to get on there and take a look at the, because you have the right, you know, as long as they give you the right. The meters are set up for you to go in and look at your own meter reads daily. They're live reads. So if you'd like to keep, I do have a couple of other property management people that are on there that monitor those all throughout the year so that you can keep an eye on them instead of the homeowner or the homeowner both to see when it gives you a temperature. If the pipes are going to freeze, you'll know it. It gives you a temperature. It tells you exactly what in the house is being used, whether it's a toilet, a sink, whatever. And it gives you real-time reading. So you'll be able to look at that and keep an eye on you know, how much water is being used daily. So if you'd like, get with me get with me next week or something, and we can figure out how to get you onto that so that you can keep an eye on it. But those have been in place since, I think, July when we installed
them. You and I have been in contact via email, mm-hmm. and I received those alerts, mm-hmm. but I haven't received the actual... alert that tells me that I've been overcharged. Is that only going to go to the homeowner?
It shows up on their monthly invoice. Unless there's something different they would like for you to receive, it goes out on their monthly invoice.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Good. Okay. So we're at the point of the agenda where we go into what's called closed session. Okay. This is where we discuss the highly specific issues. It's just part of our standard practice. So our guests won't be able to hang out and listen to this, but they'll be able to come back in shortly, I'd like to think, and rejoin the meeting. The rest of the meeting revolves around these resolutions, okay, that we have on our agenda. And so that's gonna be all in favor, all not in favor.
Mr. Chair, and just so you know, for the guests, they can be put in a waiting room mm-hmm. and then allowed back into this meeting so they don't have to log off. But Mr. Chair, with that, I'll move that we go into closed session to discuss litigation, property acquisition, or personnel.
A second.
Well, I'll take that as a motion. Do I have a second? Bob Bingham. Carrie, roll call, please.
Trustee Barrett?
No need.
Trustee Barrett?
Aye.
Trustee Bingham?
Aye.
Trustee Harvey?
Aye.
Trustee Cabot?
Aye.
Okay.